It's the 85th reel of Seawall Movies, and Carlos joins the boys in on the fun. They start in the past with the non-traditional Christmas classic, Gremlins. From one Spielberg film to another, they head to the theater to check out his first animated film, The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. For the future, they review the new trailer for The Dark Knight Rises, along with some updated movie news. It's the 85th reel of Seawall Movies. How much for that Mogwai in the window?
The past.
You telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
The present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
The future.
Hi. Welcome to the future.
And I'm telling you, it's great here.
You are listening to COL Movies.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a brand spanking new reel of COL Movies. This is reel number 85, and I would like to introduce... This is actually a very special reel, by the way. Not one of those, like a holiday afternoon special. On a very very special episode of Friends. Anyways, my jocund ho-hosts, if I pronounce that correctly, Ray and Steve are here, but also we have very special guest, Carlos. How all three of you are doing?
Hanging.
Yeah, I'm full. Let's just say that.
We won't talk about that.
Oh, jeez.
I've had a very long day.
No.
Okay. In any case, moving on. So with this episode, we have a special guest who will appear occasionally on the show. Maybe fill in whenever we end up missing somebody, which would be nice. Maybe don't have to move the dates around on occasion. But we'll hope you will enjoy your first episode with us, Carlos.
I do. I kind of miss it. In college days, I spent some time on a radio show about movies. And so I forgot how much fun, until Ray mentioned it to me, I had forgotten how much fun it was to just ramble on and pretend that people are listening.
We're good at that.
And still trying to keep it in some sort of time constraint.
Oh, yes.
Anyways.
And, yeah. Try.
So let's go on into the news.
News on the mark.
Possible Gremlins 3?
Yeah, I put, just so happens this story came out, on the 23rd. More than just the Gremlins 3, though. I guess one of the big telling things, right, these days, and it's not always true, but, movie companies have to kind of go out and sort of buy up all the, URLs to prevent, like, squatters from buying them and then having to pay way too much money to get them back from them, or to have to fight them in court for them. So there's been a few that have shown up. So Warner Brothers has recently renewed the URL for gremlins3.com.
Nobody's
really sure whether or not that means that there's going to be a movie or not, but they also renewed one for the Green Lantern. So there's a Green Lantern sequel or Green Lantern 2 URL and a Hangover 3 URL that were all registered on the same day.
Really?
So
Hangover 3, do we really need that?
Yeah.
Yes, well, we do, because there's just so many places you can get drunk and have crazy things happen to you.
Yeah. So, there's Mission Impossible 5 has been registered.
Well, there's no doubt that's going to happen.
Well, it was a little bit up in the air because they really weren't expecting 4 to be doing as well as it's been doing in the theater. So it seems like they're building bridges again. Paramount and Mr. Cruise are sort of putting down the torches.
Isn't J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot Company still involved in the show?
Yeah, they're the executive producers of it. Tom Cruise is running it, but they produced this one.
Mm. Yeah, and Brad Bird.
I think they did 3 or 2 as well.
Yeah. I can imagine a scenario where Tom Cruise and Paramount decided, I'll sell you the franchise and I'll get money out of it, but it won't be my franchise anymore. You guys can just go run it. Mm. That would seem to make sense because theoretically this would be Tom Cruise's final Mission Impossible.
Right. But there, I guess there's also speculation that they're going to keep him around now, since the last one has been so successful. Because it's supposed to, they were supposed to pass it to Jeremy Renner, I think, was supposed to be the next Ethan Hunt.
Sorry, I'm sorry I'm being quiet. I'm just sitting here shaking my head going like, who the hell is watching the internet to find out which URLs are being bought?
Oh, a ton of people.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, who has enough time on their hands to do that?
Oh, you'd be surprised. I mean, like, I know the guys that run all the Apple rumors websites. I mean, they search for Apple registering anything, you know, like just watch. You know.
I'm imagining some guy sitting in a basement somewhere going, thinking of URLs and typing them in. Enter.
Right.
It exists.
That's exactly my point. I'm sitting here thinking, I'm just thinking of some guy, you know, like I'm thinking the guy from, you know, Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
Like sitting there like, oh my gosh, Gremlins 3 got bought. Like that. And I'm like, what the hell?
Who would have thought to look for Gremlins 3?
Yeah, exactly.
Probably not too far from the truth, though.
Did he?
Well, I'm sure,
Gremlins -3 and Gremlins 3 written out. Jesus Christmas.
Well, also, this says that Paramount renewed Gremlins 3, so this was probably been around for a while. So somebody probably did see it like years ago and has been watching. Okay, it's supposed to expire now. Maybe I can get it. They renewed it.
Also, it's not entirely impossible for someone to pay the registration companies just to give them a list of the registered what was free, not free. So I mean, I guess it's a public record thing. You can find out who's registered to what website, but you can find out a list of all websites.
Just a who is search will also work for that too.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's just weird. I'm sorry. I don't have enough time.
I know. Yeah. That's why we read the blogs.
That's why other people do it for us. Of course.
That's why Gizmodo exists to save me from looking shit up.
Yeah, exactly. Gizmodo and Gadget. I'm not so fond of Gizmodo, but that's beside the point. moving on, yet another Fast and Furious movie.
Well, not just one other, but two more.
Excuse me.
You know, the last one to come out was 5, which was a surprise hit.
I don't understand why people think it's a surprise hit. I'm confused by this.
Well, I'm not sure that... Well, it's not so much that it was a hit, but that it was as big of a hit as it was.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it grossed $626 million worldwide.
Well, 2, 3, and 4 didn't do that great.
Did they? I mean, you're surprised the power of the Vin Diesel does.
Yeah.
I mean, The Rock. Well, that was for Fast 5 because The Rock wasn't in any of the previous movies. Vin Diesel wasn't in Tokyo Drift, from what I understand.
Was he? I don't remember him in Tokyo Drift.
No, he wasn't.
Okay. That's what I'm saying. But I'm just like, you know, we start off with Fast and Furious, which is great. Then it went to Fast and Furious, I think.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Which introduced
and then it just kind of went, same old.
It went into genre land. We're like, we're going to release almost these direct-to-video quickie things. Mm-hmm. And now they've started.
Exactly. More. So, and then 3, and then 4. And then there's some people who are like, yeah, these movies are great, but it's kind of like more of a cult following type thing. And then all of a sudden Fast 5 comes out and boom, it just exploded. Being like, oh, this was an awesome movie. It grossed $626 million.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it compared to the you know, between the first and then the fifth, those three movies in the middle.
But the reason why I put this on here is because of the fact that the reason why we know that there's going to be a seventh movie is because they are doing what they did with, say, Harry Potter, and what they're doing with The Hobbit, is that it's going to be one story split over two movies.
Oh, God.
Well, I think the difference here is that Fast and the Furious was an action movie with all this sort of truck, this car culture thing. And then Too Fast, Too Furious, and especially Tokyo Drift, were like almost like these weird like niche movies where they really were about the cars. Like there was really not sense of story. There was no sense of overarching character. It was just we're going to look at these cars and talk about tuning them. And I think that has a niche appeal. Whereas Fast, like the marketing for 5 was pretty much, we're going to throw these guys off a bridge. Come see that. Because that's definitely what happened.
You got all these stars. And
I don't care. And then they throw him off the bridge. And I'm like, that's going to happen in the movie? Like, the car just went off the cliff over a bridge. I have to go see to find out what happens. And so now it seems that with 6 and 7, it's going to be consistent between the two movies about what kind of movie they're going to be, and it won't be flying through this one off property thing where every movie is going to be its own little condensed thing.
Yeah. So the 2, 3, and 4 was more like shiny.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, especially Tokyo Drift was like, it was really about drifting through turns. I mean, I felt like you was a manual on how to tune your car.
Right. Well, it was. I felt it was an attempt for them to sort of validate themselves against the culture that sort of started that whole movement. So they're like, we're going to take it to Japan and be like real and pay tribute to.
I guess that's fine, but you're not going to get $626 million in that direction.
Yeah. But what cracked me up is it says that, quoting Mr. The Rock here, he says, we have to pay off this story. We have to service all these character relationships. And when we started mapping all that out, it just went beyond 110 pages. The studio said, you can't fit all that story into one damn movie, because in reality, why should the studio make money off of only one movie when they can double their profits? Which makes me laugh, because, you know, that's really a gamble, because if they commit to making two movies and the first one tanks, you know, the second one, if they manage to finish production, you know, if they shoot them back to back or whatever they do, then that's, to me, that's like a huge gamble. And especially with this franchise, I think it is a big gamble.
Yeah, it is. But the payoff is pretty big. And also, I would argue, like you do with, these are completely different movies, but I think the idea is the same. Twilight and the Harry Potter movies, you don't treat them like they're two movies. You say, come now, come next year, finish the story. And I think the gamble isn't so heavy. If you can actually have a story that has some sense of people care, then people will want to see how it happens, how it ends, even if it isn't $626 million. And, you know, cost-wise, you know, if you film them at the same time together, it's not really that much more expensive.
Yeah.
Well, like two huge movies, you know, it's one ginormous movie.
Mm-hmm. I don't like the trend. That's just my own thing. It's just like we were talking back when 3D kind of like was really hitting everything and everything was coming out in 3D. It's just like, why do we keep going through the trend? I mean, one good thing I will give is at least it's new material.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say that much. You know, it's not a remake or a reboot of something and they're stretching it into two films.
Yeah.
You know, at least it's new material. I'll give them that much.
I will say this, combined to what you're saying, Steve, it bothers me. This weekend I saw three movies, and I saw three movies in three different theaters in New York. And one was an IMAX movie, and the other one was sort of like, it was a time that I needed to go see it, but they had some weird title on it. So I'm like, what is this? And they're like, oh, that's our special theater here. And so I go, and it's this huge screen, and they spent 5 minutes showing off the sound system. And there's a tagline where it's sort of like, go big or go home. And I think people, this trend of everything having to be bigger and more and more story and make you come now and later, literally, it's really about trying to distinguish it as being different from what you can just watch on Netflix, watch on cable, watch in TV movies. It's trying to provide a different experience than what people are doing. But it's like, I just want to go watch a movie. I don't have to watch every movie doesn't have to be this huge event thing. I just want to go watch a movie. But the reality is, like, I took my brother to a movie today, and he hadn't gone to a movie in like 6 months because there hadn't been anything that grabbed him to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Fast Furious 6 will grab him because it'll be two movies and Rock and Vin together again kind of thing.
Now, sequels still having this like continuous storyline between multiple movies can still happen. I mean, they've done some good jobs in the past, such as Back to the Future and, you know, Star Wars, essentially, the original trilogy. I don't count the first one because it doesn't exist in my mind. Mm-hmm. But those two trilogies are essentially one story through three movies. But the nice thing that they did was they really made it more of each movie can be seen by itself as one single story.
Each is a standalone project. Correct. Mm-hmm. I agree with that 100%.
So if you do plan on doing this like continuous storyline thing, you just need to say, okay, what's the first story? And do a story from beginning to end. There is somehow a connection to the next movie, but you know what? If you just had the first movie, boom, you're done. You're good. That's okay. And it's just nice to see something carry on into the next movie. Actually, the Batman movies, the Nolan movies, Nolanverse movies, has been doing a good job for that because he keeps saying this is a trilogy. So we've got Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises as three movies. Each one is a story in and of itself, but there's still supposed to be kind of this storyline that almost, I'm assuming, is the rise and fall of Batman or something like that. Or the fall and rise or something. I don't know. But that's another example of how, where it can be good. It's just trying to keep that singular story per movie, but still having some sort of connection between the two.
I guess I just never felt that the Fast and the Furious franchise was a strong enough narrative to warrant an overarching storyline between two movies. Like, I never felt that, you know, they didn't tell the story that they meant to tell in this movie because they had to cut everything out for time. You know, they didn't want to make a 4-hour long film.
That it even garnered like having a multiple movie deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I get that. Okay, every once in a while something comes up and there's a new something and they want to throw it in the Fast and Furious franchise. I can get that. But to say that they're going to develop additional films over a certain period of time, you know, kind of, I'm like, couldn't they have come up with like a better franchise? You know?
Well, to me, it's like if they would have said, and don't get me wrong, I like some of the Fast and the Furious because I love the cars, mm-hmm. and I've been in and out of that car culture. Absolutely. But like, to me, it's like somebody saying, you know what? We're going to make this movie called Cannonball Run, and we don't know if we're going to be able to fit all we want to say in that first movie, so we're going to do it as a two-parter, you know, that kind of film. Like, it would boggle my mind if they're like, yeah, Cannonball Run Part 1 and Part 2, you know? Like, I don't know.
I get a little problematic when we start saying, well, this movie deserves to have more movies made out of it. This one doesn't. Because that can be like an individual kind of judgment thing. Like, you can have action movies with depth to them that lead to like seeing these characters continue onward and seeing what happens to them next. Okay. I think we're right. I think we are all agreeing, though, that this seems to be a knee jerk. Hey, we didn't really plan for these characters to be deep, but now we kind of need them to. So let's pretend that they are deep enough to have this 4-hour story, which they really don't. But that being said,
we could go right back to our first movie here and suddenly say Gremlins 3. Okay. We just found out Gremlins 3 is going to have a 4-hour movie. So it's going to be broken into two individual films.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. When was the last Gremlins?
1990.
Okay. Would it make sense? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, right. I feel like they could do that with a lot of these franchises.
How old does a Mogwai get before it dies? I mean, what's its lifespan?
The mythology isn't that deep. They're going to have 4 hours to talk about it. I'm sure they'll figure that part out.
Yeah.
Oh, Gizmo, you're looking as young as you were way back 20 years ago.
Probably
almost 30 years now.
How about we do this? Since we're talking about it, let's talk about Gremlins.
Oh, and skip the last story here?
Yes.
Okay, well, skipping last story.
You're going to skip Wolfie Ben Affleck?
Do you really want to talk about it, Steven?
Well, did you see the pictures?
No.
Yeah, but I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. There's a movie coming out in 2012 called Argo, which the movie itself is going to be about a group of CIA agents who go over to Iran, making sure I had this correct, they go over to Tehran, and they go over posing as film crew guys, okay? Like they're out there going to scout, you know, mm-hmm. a whole film crew area. And while they're out there, they actually try to release hostages that have been taken, you know, in Tehran in 1979. Well, as part of it, of course, they have to make the actors look 79, like 1979-ish. And Ben Affleck, full beard, goofy hair, looks kind of cool.
I would not have recognized him.
Yeah, exactly. Looks kind of nice. I'm not going to lie to you.
I don't get the Wolfie Ben Affleck part.
Oh. It's all subjective, my friend.
Oh, Lord.
So let's talk about Gremlins.
Jeff's looking at this photo now.
I forgot. Jeff doesn't like it. Moving on.
Moving on into the past.
Tell me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Gremlins. Rotten Tomatoes rating 79%, fresh 70% audience, directed by Joe Dante, starring Zach Galligan, Phoebe Cates, Hoyt Exton. Howie Mandel is the voice of Gizmo, which is basically his voice for Bobby, but we'll get into that later. Frank Welker, who is the voice of Stripe.
And Megatron.
That was Megatron, too?
Mm-hmm.
Cartoon Megatron or the no
cartoon Megatron.
Okay, I didn't like Megatron's voice.
Look at Frank Welker's IMDb page. That man works, dude. Holy crap! Is there a ton of listings for him? So yeah, I had to put him on.
Yeah, you totally gave Jeff a boner, and then he just
didn't. No, because I do not like. I do not.
I know.
Like
that's why I said. That. That's why I said you got excited. I could hear it in your voice.
He was the voice of.
Then it went wah wah.
Oh wait a minute, he was. He did the voice of Shockwave, Soundwave, and Barricade in Dark of the Moon.
Yeah, he was in the movie. Didn't do because what's his name? Agent Smith was Megatron in Transformers.
Yes, see that was a much better Megatron voice, by the way. If you're gonna give me a hard on from Transformers, you talk about Peter Cullen. That's all I'm going to say. That's the only one out of that, anyways.
Back to Gremlins.
Gremlins. So, Christmas movie?
Here's the thing. I thought it was funny because I have this thing about non-traditional Christmas movies.
Yes.
Okay. I love non-traditional movies. And we talked about it a little last week when we said, like, Die Hard. You were going to watch Die Hard. It's like a Christmas flick, which it is. Die Hard to me is a non-traditional Christmas movie. 12 Monkeys is a non-traditional Christmas movie.
You're going to have to pause there for a moment because you're going to have to define what a Christmas movie, just a movie that happens around Christmas.
Yes, I like to say that, you know, there's certain parts of the holiday that are in the movie for some reason.
Okay, if that's all you're going to require, then yeah.
Yeah, I don't need it to be. The movie doesn't need to be about the Christmas mythology at all, or the holiday. But
there has to be some sort of like significant effect, being that it's in Christmas. It has to be like, you know, effectively take place around Christmas. You know, there's an action involving Christmas. In this case, Gizmo was a Christmas present, and it takes place around Christmas. And Die Hard, it was, you know, there was Christmas music through the whole thing. It was Christmas time. You knew that. Well, so there's got to be that significant of event.
I would probably narrow it down for you. I think what you're saying is that what happens in the movie could only happen at Christmas. Like Die Hard, he's going to visit his ex-wife to give her a Christmas present for Christmas. Home Alone, they're leaving to go on their Christmas vacation. They leave him alone, and no one else is there because everybody's away for Christmas.
Right.
You know, and obviously Gremlins, true, it's a Christmas present. So it's not just that it happens at Christmas, but something about the season is sort of part of the plot of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I thought the monkey is getting a little fuzzy.
Because I was gonna say otherwise, you know, Fuzz enjoys Christmas movies that fuck with people's Christmases.
Oh yeah, totally.
That's pretty much it. You know.
So I did get some. Well, unfortunately, they responded on my page and not COL. I only got one response on there. But some other ones that people listed. Obviously, people listed A Christmas Story, but that to me, that's a giving away. Now, this is a movie I've never seen and I'm not familiar with. Maybe one of you guys, Lion in Winter?
Yes, The Lion in Winter.
Okay.
I have not seen.
It's Lion in Winter. It's really a play. It's a play movie. It's okay. About one of the Henrys and his three sons. And it's set at Christmas time.
Okay.
But it's really about this sort of political intrigue sort of thing. But right. If you want to just place it as, you know, it's like near his death. He has to plan which son he has to get his inheritance. His wife is very involved.
Now
I'm gonna be thinking about Christmas movies.
Well, the other one is, somebody mentioned The Ref, which I don't think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And Dutch was another one.
I saw that a couple of times.
Bad Santa's come up on the list. A very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas came up in this discussion.
What about
American Psycho?
Futurama American, Christmas.
Wait, yeah. American Psycho?
American Psycho came up. Because I guess it's set during Christmas time and there's scenes where Christian Bale's character goes to a Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to his girlfriend's Christmas party during there and has this sort of weird Christmas conversation. So there's a whole bunch of really weird ones. Of course, Gremlins came up on the list. The Nightmare Before Christmas is one of my big ones. Another one that came up that was a really weird one for me was Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, yes. That's awesome.
Oh, my God.
That's so awesome.
Did that really have a... There's something
it happens during Christmas time. But
that's gotta get on our list.
Came up the most was Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, classic. That's probably the best example of like the dark fairy tale.
Yeah. So I was filmed about
2 miles from my house.
Yeah. Sweet.
Yep. In Lutz, Florida. When I was in high school, a bunch of us were like extras and all kinds of stuff in that movie.
Right. So interesting thing about Gremlins being called a non-traditional Christmas movie is that it was originally supposed to be released at Christmas the year it came out, but it got moved up to June.
Which is kind of like a Die Hard, I think, too.
Yeah, it got moved up to June because the studio felt that there wasn't any competition against Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters.
Oh, Spielberg. Spielberg joint.
Right. So they decided to put it up against those two movies. And the funny thing is, I remember seeing every single one of those.
All of those movies, yes. Yep.
So that was like a magical summer for me. Because Gremlins, let me put it this way, I fell in love with the movie Gremlins. I thought it was awesome.
Yep.
I was 9 when I watched this movie in the theater.
I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was 3, almost 4.
I was, yeah, barely 4.
I named
4.
A dog after Gizmo.
Jeez.
Yes.
You're old.
I still have a Gizmo.
No, that's right. Carlos and I are the same age.
Yeah, so
Gizmo doll.
No, but I think Gremlins is a great example of the non-traditional Christmas movie, mm-hmm. if only because it's really sincerely about Christmas. Like, it's not just trying to screw with you by being a horror movie. Like, mm-hmm. We're not just talking about, oh, he gets a gift or stuff. But like, it talks about from the beginning, like the first 20 minutes set up what Christmas is like for these people. You know, mm-hmm. he's trying to get his gift. You know, they don't have a lot of money. You know, there's this, that, and the other thing. People are out of work. You know, it's the Christmas season. People are losing their jobs and, you know, things like that. And then, of course, you have the best conversation I've ever seen that I forgot totally about from when I saw it the first time, where she's talking about how many people die during Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when it starts me realizing that the crazy guy from World War II, the shrew banker, these people shouldn't really be very happy right about now. Things aren't really very happy and well with these people, even though it's Christmas time. So it kind of has this sort of nice, evil, you're pretending to be happy even when you're not. when the world is falling apart, you're still pretending to be happy just because it's Christmas. So it's nice. It's subversive in that way, and I was pretty impressed with how nice that held together until obviously the Gremlins came out, and then suddenly it becomes a horror film.
Right. Well, the funny thing about this movie, and it's been a while since I actually sat down and watched, like, intently watched this movie again. Like, I probably have seen it on TV a couple times over the years. But watching this again and paying that much attention to it, it's really struck me on how dark this movie is as far as, like, some of the subject matter and some of the things that happen. And it's funny because when I was doing the research and putting in some of the trivia, that this movie and Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Doom that came out that same year were the movies that influenced the MPAA to create the PG-13 rating.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's more than influence. I mean, the story is that, you know, they made the movie and they're like, this isn't PG. This is R. And Spielberg was loud enough and the studios loud enough that they said, no, you have to create a new rating because this isn't R and this isn't PG. And it became PG-13. And even more interesting, PG-13 became the target. You want your because that's the broadest possible audience, including the little kids and the sort of adults. But that isn't alienating because there are no adults go see a PG movie and no kids go see an R movie. But PG-13, everyone sees.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of a watershed.
Seeing it.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I thought it was really interesting. A couple other little facts in here. The old Chinese guy, Mr. Wing, almost got cast as to be played by John Pertwee, which I don't know if am I the only Doctor Who geek here in this crowd.
Yep.
Okay.
That, yeah. No, would know that, yeah.
All right. So, but the movie in general, I was just like, I was amazed at how dark it actually was. I think most of the violence and stuff and a lot of the dark subject matter as far as, like, you know, oh, suicide rates spike and the girl's father dying on Christmas. I think that was lost on me as a 9-year-old. I just didn't pay any attention to any of that. And to me, it was just about the creatures and what was going on with them. And so I really paid a lot more attention to that.
I think you originally probably did think it was dark because of the lighting.
This movie is shot horribly.
well, besides the fact that I don't think it was necessarily shot horribly. I mean, the lighting, to me, the lighting was low because of the fact that Mowgli and Gremlins don't like bright lights.
Right.
You can't. They don't like the sun. Exactly. So it was dark for a reason when it came to lighting. And I'm sure there could have been more creative ways of, you know, still allowing some sort of, you know, make it so you can see more in the dark.
I would put $5 down that at some point in the pre-production for this movie, they were like, okay, so all these puppets and these things that are moving around and these animatronics, they would look better if they aren't too well lit.
Yes.
Yeah. Because it shows. It's not like, I mean, there's no reason why the bathroom light is on when he walks in. I mean, like, there are all these little moments that it doesn't have to be as dark as it is. I think they just tried to dim it down because especially the monster gremlins look better that way. Right. Like the close up of Gizmo were pretty well lit, but whenever, you know, he's sitting on a table or something, they hide him. They put him in a helmet or they put him behind some pillows.
Well,
dim the lights a bit.
Originally,
it's a good way to save money. It's a good way to save money too.
He wasn't supposed to be in more than the first half of the movie either.
Yeah,
he was supposed to actually turn into one of the evil gremlins, but they decided. Mr. Spielberg said that no, he needed to be through the whole movie because the audience would identify with him, and that he ultimately became the hero of the film. But yeah, the Gizmo puppet actually was not designed to be in more than the opening scene. So a lot of the stuff that they did at the end, you know, was kind of not expected. So a lot of those close-ups that they did, you know, the puppet wasn't really supposed to be designed to hold up to that kind of stuff. But it kind of segues into the other thing I want to talk about. And it's kind of interesting that we're talking about Gremlins sequels. If they were to make a Gremlins 3... How do you guys feel about the use of the practical effects, the use of the actual puppets and puppeteering versus would they be better served to go all CG or a mix of CG or just go
they have
puppets?
They have to go practical.
Yeah.
Have to.
Yeah,
and
I
the
agree.
Reason for that because what is the reason for they have to be practical?
I just think it's because it has to be consistent. I think we've learned from other movies like The Howlings, the American Werewolf in London series, the others that when they switch from one to the other, it just looks like crap. And the people that are purists for the early movies, just like me, I get lost. I turn like when I saw American Werewolf in Paris, I was just like, I want to walk out right now. Because I was really excited because I liked American Werewolf in London. And then I went in there and the whole thing was CG. And so the same with the later Howling movies, even though they went straight to DVD. You know, it just turns you off.
I'm not sure
there's even like a practical effects department anymore in Hollywood.
I think they have to be created for the movie if they're going to use them. But I think it can go both ways, though, because to me, like, take Yoda from Episode 1.
Okay. True.
To me, that's another good example of practical effects gone horribly wrong. Because Yoda in that movie looked awful. And the CG Yoda I was much more accepting of. But of course, they didn't jump back and forth between CG and non-CG. I think I would be happy if a majority of the effects in the sequel would be practical. But be sort of enhanced, like movement could be enhanced, or if they're going to do something.
Well, the reality is that they'll use both. I'm sure that that's
They will.
Every movie gets digitally affected nowadays. Right. My only thing about this is that the practical effects of the movie created limits. Limits are wonderful because you learn to work around them, but you have to be able to work around them. Like the first when the gremlin jumps into the pool, it is very odd. Because he, if I'm remembering correctly, he walks in. He's walking down the street. He goes to the WCA, and then the alarm goes off. He walks over to the alarm. The gremlin jumps out of the alarm box. He falls to the floor. He scratches the gremlin, and the gremlin runs into the pool. And my first thought was like, they were in the pool, and. You know, and part of it is, you know, when they're shooting it, they have to shoot it a certain way in order for the practical effect to work. So, you know, they can't have the pool there. And then I'm sure that there were limits to how they could use the practical effect itself to make it work. But then you end up in some beautiful, like any of the Dark Crystal movies and any of the Henson movies, they did wonderful ways of working with the puppets without feeling like you're losing anything. And considering that no one's used a practical effect in a long time, I think it's end up being it's a moot point in terms of what we want to happen. They're going to end up having to do everything digitally. Whether or not I would like them to keep them unlike what they did with Yoda. Yoda went from this sort of like turtle to this like action figure. So the character changed in the sense of how they did it. You know, they had done Yoda just being Yoda, meaning slow, grumbling, rumbling. I would have been fine. But once he starts jumping around, he stops being Yoda. He starts being some other character.
That's my concern. Is that they're going to turn it from, you know, they're going to go from being what they are and what we know them to be in the classic sense to being Yoda. That's what I don't want. I don't want it to turn into that, you know. And, you know, next thing we know, the Muppets are all going to be CG.
Yeah. Well, the Muppets are different. But I agree with you. I think it's not an issue of tools, though. It's an issue of, like, decision-making when you're deciding what these things are going to do, look like, feel like. Yoda's not a problem of technology. It's a problem of George Lucas being
an ass.
Yeah. My vote is keep them practical.
Yeah, and they probably should hire Jim Henson Studios to come in and take care of the gremlins, because I can almost guarantee that they go to the Jim Henson Studios. I don't know who's running it right now, because I don't think it actually is Brian Henson anymore.
Disney owns them.
But in any case, they go to them specifically and they say, okay, we're going to do a Gremlins movie, but we want to make sure that it's practical because we want to keep with that. But we also want it to look really, really good. And you know what? You guys just made this Muppet movie, which was really, really good. So we want you to do this. And they will, to the detail, replicate the original Gremlins and Mowgli. Of course, they probably could get the props from the original movies, too, to as reference. And they would make sure that they carry it over. And then they might be able to figure out things to make them a little bit more lifelike or something, and not as staccato puppety.
Yeah.
You know, but still have them be practical, still have them be puppets. In this case, they'll end up being Muppets, but I mean, they were pretty much Muppets before, but that's another matter altogether.
They'll be Muppets.
But I mean, I really think that I do think that the Jim Henson Studios, and the reason why I say Jim Henson Studios over Disney is because Disney does one thing. They own Jim Henson Studios, but that studios, that group does amazing puppeteering and Muppeteering. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why whenever I see anything Muppet, I start giggling. Like I'm 5 years old. So just because they do such an amazing job, and a really creepy job in the case of Dark Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
But
I guess, I mean, I would be okay with, I mean, yeah, of course, Henson Studios is a good choice. But I mean, I think there's other, I mean, like Phil Tippett, I would be okay with him, you know, being involved. I think his studio does some pretty cool stuff. I don't think they've been too much involved lately in things. I know that they did a lot of the stuff for Twilight and a couple other things, but I guess I would agree in the fact that I feel that the Henson Studios would keep sort of the whimsy of the Gremlins. To me, that's the important thing I don't want to lose. Yeah. Oh, even though they're these little evil creatures, they're like sort of goofy, you know, like they're joking around with each other and laughing and causing.
They
all
each have a personality. They're like the Smurfs. They're like the evil Smurfs.
Right. The only thing that I don't want to see happen is to them just turn into. Don't want it to turn into a creature flick, like a horror flick.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is not what is it? Critters. Critters.
Yeah. Known. Or Tremors.
Right.
That is an interesting point because that brings up something else that I noticed is that this movie is very 1984.
And
there's a sense of this sense of humor and this sense of movies we don't really have anymore. Like, one, it's a really small movie. Like, I hadn't seen it in a long time. And so I was struck when the first shot is of an alleyway. And it's like this tiny little alleyway on, like, in Chinatown, I guess, in some Chinatown somewhere.
Yep.
And one, it's the same, for me, it looks like the same back lot that they shot Little Shop of Horrors in, Little Trouble in Big China. Like, there's just Big Trouble in Little China, like on and on. Like, it's just a back lot where they just filled people in at night and just shot them there. And, you know, there's no sweeping shot of the city so you know where they are. Like, whereas now every movie starts with this sort of like sky shot. Mm-hmm. But then little things like the relationship between him and the girl is so incredibly innocent at the beginning. Mm-hmm. The dad, the inventor dad, and the weird, we'll get to the dad later, by the way, because there's. I had forgotten about the dad, but anyway.
Forget about him.
Yeah, I was really surprised by how I didn't remember him. But like, there are a lot of little things that I found charming. But I was like, I hate when people say we don't make movies like that anymore, like some sort of like dismissal. But the reality is that it's not 1984 anymore, and I don't know if you can have this whimsical, creepy, crawly character and have people buy it as much anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching the movie trying to figure out whether or not. I didn't know there was going to be a sequel, but just whether or not, like, if someone made this character, we're not talking about the way it looked or the way, you know, we want it to look, just like this plot line and this storyline, and he has a mohawk, and they're just loud and rowdy, and, you know, it's like, would this pass, or would people just sort of laugh at them and not really see them as interesting and creepy?
Right.
It's a good point.
And by the way, it was the town was the same set as Back to the Future.
Oh, okay, so it was the same set. Yeah, it's not like a negative. It's just a matter of this is how they made movies back then, where they still kind of went to the same sets and did them. Whereas now they would shoot it in, you know, Vancouver or something, and there would be mountains in it somewhere.
Everything's on location. They're you know, very little done on back lots these days.
But the father,
bat locks.
Yeah. I realized that I had combined the father with the father from the Wonder Years and the father from Teen Wolf. Like, those three fathers combined into one father in my mind. I didn't think they were the same actor or anything, but it's just a sense of that dad.
Right.
And I
am so mad you made a Captain Planet reference, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, I must have seen this movie when I was 15 or so. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I was conscious enough of my own sort of sexuality to be attracted to the dad. Mm-hmm. But this time watching it, I could not help but go, that voice, that chest hair. Why do we see his chest hair all the time? I don't know, but it's there. Like that itinerant inventor thing was just like, I want more of the dad. I want to see more of this dad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad I wasn't alone about that.
No. I always remember being fascinated by him in the movie. Mm-hmm. Didn't really understand why back then, but I always remembered sort of being fascinated. Part of it was, I think, obviously that there was, you know, the physical thing that was going on for me in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. But I also love the inventor thing.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, wow. You know, and the fact that he's always trying to, you know, I got this problem that, you know, you got a problem there. I can solve it. Here's what you need to do. You need to do this, that whole sort of stick, just sort of
smokeless ashtray.
Yeah.
So also, there's a weird scene where he goes to some convention and there's like the robot from Lost.
Robbie the robot.
The time machine.
That's another moment. I'm like, this is why I was like, the movie isn't well shot. Isn't.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, we don't need this scene at all. This scene doesn't have to be here, but yet it's here, and we don't learn anything except that he's away for Christmas. Like they could have done that in conversation. So it's kind of neat to see that because they had all these other characters like walking in that scene, and you're like, wait, I want to spend time at that place.
Yeah, I have a feeling that was sort of like the guys on the production team and maybe Steven Spielberg going, we just want to throw these in the movie somehow. So we're going to have him go to this convention where we can just throw all these goofy things in there.
Yeah, but they were running around the back lots and they saw all these other things back in storage. And they're like, ooh, let's put this in the movie somehow. How do we do that? Mm-hmm. Oh, let's send him to an inventor's convention. They could just be lying around.
Right.
Yeah, it's great. And that father, I looked him up and know afterwards. He was a country western singer. I didn't go through the trouble of seeing what his other credits are because I didn't remember him. So I figured that he wasn't in anything. But it just he's wonderful and charming, and he fits pants well. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he was the thing that I think I remember him the most from was from the I'm going to blank on it now. Was a Western TV show from the 70s.
Lonesome Dove?
No.
Silverado? I think I know which one you're talking about.
Bonanza.
Bonanza. Oh, yeah. Wow. No, he wasn't like the one. He wasn't Hoss.
No, but he was, I remember seeing him from there, and he was in a lot of like 70s television shows. Like he was on The Bionic Woman and Dukes of Hazzard and... He was an I Dream of Jeannie, and so he popped in and out of lots of 70s TV.
Yeah.
He's been in a lot of TV movies as well. He was Sheriff Tate in the Coal Miner Slaughter and Murder.
Nice.
He does quite a few Tate sheriffs.
So question, the logic flaw. Are you talking about? Are you talking about the After Midnight?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's always that after the very, midnight. Very first time. The very, very, very first time I saw this, I was like, "After midnight, you can never feed them." I was like, so confused.
Yeah.
As a child, even I caught that.
Okay, there had to be like some sort of like time frame, like after midnight until sunup.
Don't know. They never.
No,
said
I mean that was just. Off. I mean that was just. They just threw that in there. I mean they just. It's a logic flaw, but it's one of those. Well, we have to create a time. Just like yeah,
right.
It's not a world time. Yeah, but I agree with you that it's a logic flaw.
My brain's going. Okay, so it's always after midnight technically, and then I'm like, do they respect time zones? Like if I'm in California and also, I have a gremlin.
No, I want to think of a bigger time. Logic flaw. You can't get him wet. He can't drink water. How does this thing live without any hydration of any kind?
Yeah, well, I think it's just supposed to speak to the fact that they're like magical creatures. They're like not,
clearly.
Yeah. So they're like unicorns. They exist outside of our rules.
Yep. But, and the only other thing I really had was, I know you guys put down Howie Mandel and everything, but I noticed the voice actors at the end of the movie, and mm-hmm. I saw Michael Winslow of the Academy fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Howie and a couple other names that I'd recognized, of course, but I have to admit I had never noticed that before.
Really?
Never knew it before, but I was like, wow, they got some these days big names.
Oh,
I don't know so much that they were big then.
And Peter Cullen was in there.
Yeah, and Peter Cullen as well. I saw that too. Yeah. So Jeff.
He's got a great sexy voice, but I'm just looking at a picture of him. He's not that hot at all.
Peter Cullen, you've never seen a picture of him before?
Yeah, I just saw a picture of him the first time. That's my heart. Anyways, so with that, we're at 50 minutes. So what have we learned from Gremlins? We have learned having cable is not a successful way to pick up girls. Gremlins have perfect pitch.
Oh, I forgot about the Judd Reinhold yuppie, like 80s comment thing. Okay, moving on.
Suicide rates are always highest during the holidays. The smaller the animal, the faster the heartbeat. And don't expose them to light, don't get them wet, and never feed them after midnight. So never feed them. And that is what we've learned from Gremlins. An incredibly classic movie, but I didn't feel like it held up. Still feels very dated, but getting past that, still love it. Made me want to watch the sequel.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite non-traditional Christmas movies. I think it's worth watching. I think everybody should check it out, but it's one of those things where you're going to have to make sure you watch it if you have kids before you decide if it's appropriate for them, because you might have some traumatized youngsters.
I would agree with you on that one. I think it's definitely a great film as a whole, and I still have my gizmo, so yay. I love that it's practical, even if it doesn't quite stand up to this test of time. It's a classic. Leave it as it is.
Carlos.
I was surprised by how violent it was, and we already talked about some of that, but like the blender, the microwave, you know, the swords, like it's physical in the violence. And I was also surprised by how it still is subversive in a nice way, that, you know, kids of a certain age will kind of start seeing a little bit through the hypocritical or somewhat fake side of Christmas. But it really does do well in being a thrilling horror movie with little pieces of like chocolate in it that kind of make you think. And then, of course, you want to hug the gizmo forever.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to hug him and space him and love him forever. Moving on into the present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. Although it didn't really have that on most of the title things, but it is a subtitle. Rotten Tomatoes rating of 75% fresh, 80% audience, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Jamie Bell, Andy Serkis, Daniel Craig, Nick Frost, and Simon Pegg. I had to end those last two. They had at the in front of, at the Alamo here, they had this like Adventures of Tintin quiz where they quizzed Jamie Bell, who does the voice for Tintin, as well as Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, who play Thompson and Thompson. In trivia about Tintin, like the names of the books and certain things. So, needless to say, Nick Frost had his full beard on and was looking awfully sexy, but that's just me.
I have to admit something here. I had never exposed myself to any of the source material. I was aware of Tintin, but since I never really actually read any of it, I always thought Tintin was the dog.
I did too.
you're thinking of Rin Tintin.
I know, but I always thought Tintin was the dog, honest to God. Because of the little bit I had seen of the comic, you know, the dog talks, you know, in thought bubbles that I guess the rest of the world doesn't see. or he doesn't really, you know, communicate with anybody else, but you see his statements and his commentary sort of in these little thought bubbles of what he's thinking about. So I always thought that, like, he was the main character of the stories. So I always just assumed that when we were talking about the Adventures of Tintin, that it was, I didn't think the guy's name was Tintin. I'm like, sounds like a dog's name, you know? So yeah,
Tintin canine cop.
Mm-hmm. So I have to admit that first before we talk about it.
Well, now that you know it's the guy and his dog's name is Snowy.
Well, I figured that out after watching the first trailer. I mean, I saw the trailer and I'm like, okay, obviously I was wrong. Let me go read about this. You know,
the sandwich, the keys.
Mm-hmm. So,
hello. I just need to get it out before we get going. Did anybody else have issues with some of the animation as far as perspective goes? Like, I felt like some of the perspective was off. Like, their heads were too big for their bodies, and
I mean, yeah.
That
was a choice. I think that was just the way they designed. That was a choice. I mean, it's expressive faces, big eyes kind of thing, you know?
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I thought
it kind of threw me off a little bit sometimes.
I mean, Haddock's coat was bigger than his face. I mean, like, there was definitely like a sort of thing going on, but I viewed it as not as a choice. I mean, I read a lot of comics, and I read a lot of various different types of comics. So I kind of used to art styles varying. I think this was just the style that they chose.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult moving from the 2D drawing to this 3D as lifelike as they possibly could get it. Look, so I mean, that was some difficulties, and they probably were like mainly like, "Where it's not going to be the same, so we're going to try to get it as close as we can, so it's perfectly identifiable." But we know it's not going to be the same. There's going to be some rough things. I mean, the animation just in the motion capture, just in movements, and I could see that as perspective. You know, the heads might seem a little bit too big and what have you. Just everything was exaggerated. So it really felt like something that was more of something that would be great on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the stage, when, a live action performance on the stage, actors make bigger, you know, their faces are more expressive, you know, everything's more exaggerated because the person in the back of the audience needs to be able to see exactly what's going on. So you need to make it bigger in order for that to be effective. And it really felt like more of a stage show versus a movie, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was presentational. Again, I think that was because it was kind of children's theater-y. It was like communicating to these kids, these kind of things, but it can get very annoying when you aren't a child and it just looks like overacting.
True. Did anybody else know, did you watch the full opening credits or where they were doing the opening and they kind of went through the entire story?
Yeah.
Did you notice that? I kept looking because as soon as I saw it, I was kind of like, well, I kind of get the sense of what's going to happen the rest of the movie now.
Yeah. If that's a problem for you, you shouldn't watch Mission Impossible.
Okay. I don't tend to. I haven't seen since the first one.
Same thing, though, where, like, via the credits, you get the entire story of the, like, the cut-up version of the story.
Mm.
It's kind of the thing now, it seems, in credit sequences.
I'll remember that.
So the biggest problem I had with this, not so much the art style, but of course, when you come to a movie that's sort of being photorealistic in certain aspects, you get to the problem of the uncanny valley, which I felt that this movie sort of moved in and out of that. Like, there were points when I was watching it and there were certain scenes or certain shots where, if it wasn't for one particular element, it would have been hard to tell that this was all CG. The backgrounds and things were done extremely well. But there, every once in a while, something would creep in there, especially whenever they would show a close-up of Haddock's face.
Yeah.
It crossed right into the uncanny valley for me, and I was just like, oh, creepy, creepy, make it stop.
I didn't get quite that way. This wasn't the train movie, the North Polar Express, the Polar Express, where there was the dead eye thing, where you stared at their eyes and there was nothing in their eyes. They did no more to add twinkle. And there's a scene in the in Tintin where Tintin is like saying the ultimate plot point, and mm-hmm. Haddock is realizing it. Mm-hmm. I did see realization dawn in his eyes. Mm-hmm. So there were times where I didn't feel like this was a fake person.
Right.
I actually completely missed the Uncanny Valley section. I didn't feel any sense of, oh, this is mannequins walking about.
Right.
It felt like this is a plastic world and things are moving around. But I didn't feel like, I think it kind of sidestepped that realistic. I think part of it was the heads were bigger, the coats were thicker, you know, everybody was super skinny or super weirdly rounded, mm-hmm. you know. The only one, I guess, was the pickpocket was, mm-hmm. and that's because of the voice, because I was imagining Toby Jones in my head as he was speaking, and Toby Jones is this tiny, little person, and there was like a weird, like, little person inside this big sort of figure. But for the most part, I didn't get into the Polar Express where I'm supposed to think these people are real, and I know they're not, and mm-hmm. I'm confused.
Right.
I never seem to have that problem at all. Like, a lot of the times people will bring up the Uncanny Valley issue when it comes to such and such. And I'm like, what? I still don't quite understand. I personally cannot understand this Uncanny Valley issue. And I don't know if it's just because when I suspend my disbelief, I literally get rid of it. I'm like, it's gone. It's not there. There is no such thing as disbelief to me. I just accept what I'm getting as the truth, which I probably got a little bit of that Uncanny Valley feeling with the, you know, that the exaggeration, the motions, and, you know, the slight different things that they had to do for the movie, bigger heads, etc. But I just was like, okay, that's mm-hmm. what it is.
Yeah.
Moving on.
The only thing about it that bugged me was Tintin always talked with his upper and lower teeth out at the same time. And that kind of freaked me out because I'm like, I don't know anybody who does that, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was about the only thing. Otherwise, I'm like you, Jeff. When I know it's a fully animated movie, I'm going in to see.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's going to be some things that are different. I get it. The only thing that threw me off in this part, was their heads being bigger than their bodies. That perspective just threw me off, or that, you know, that bit of proportion. But otherwise, I thought it lended itself well, and I loved it. Somebody else put Indiana Jones in here because I kept thinking the whole time, I'm like, oh my god, this is totally like young Indiana Jones, and I totally wish that they had made the young Indiana Jones trilogy without that asshole. If they had just made it without him and just gone ahead and made it in full animation, I probably would have liked it.
Well, I kept waiting. There were certain scenes, like when they finally made it to their destination, and there's the scene where you're following them along in their little caravan and they're on like motorcycles, and mm-hmm. the camera sort of flies over them and you get the reveal of the city. And John Williams' music hits. I'm like, wow, yep. That's totally an Indiana Jones moment right there. I kept waiting for the Indiana Jones theme to kick in. I kept waiting for it. I was like, when's it going to happen? But, you know, I think that is intentional because I guess when the guy who created Tintin saw Indiana Jones, that he immediately felt that Steven Spielberg, who's had the rights to Tintin since like 1983, like he was the guy who would be the one to make a movie. Like,
yeah,
he understood what he was going for when he created this character and the type of story. So I don't think it's by chance that we get that feeling watching this, you know. There's Spielberg all over this movie, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, easily identified as some of the things that he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say similarly, because I was watching I was watching Mission Impossible. It made me miss James Cameron. Mm-hmm. I wish James Cameron would make a movie. And I saw the Ridley Scott trailer, and it made me realize, like, there's a Ridley Scott thing. And then you're watching this movie, you're like, Spielberg. This mm-hmm. is Spielberg action. This is what Spielberg action looks like. This is what it moves like. And this is what it looks like when he's unencumbered by having to, like, move cameras around.
Or try to move Harrison Ford in the most recent movie.
Right. Jesus. It totally makes sense. I mean, in some ways there were less Spielberg-ish notes, like the traditional stereotypical Spielberg things aren't there anymore. Like, there are no lens flares, you know. Mm-hmm. but the sequence in the Baghdad look-alike city where they're mm-hmm. racing after I've never seen something quite so perfectly executed. Like, right. almost to the point where, like, some places would have over-directed it, where you have seen every little action. But during that shot, there's stuff like, at some point, one of them jumps into the river, and you don't see him until he pops out of the river later. Like, he was in the river for at least 3-4 seconds. And we forget that he's there, and the tank that's coming down at the beginning shows up at the end. So you're like, this is all happening at the same time, and we're, like, actively choosing which things we're looking at as we're following it through. I mean, those are just sort of little things that make you really connected to the action, because you kind of get overwhelmed in the side of it. Whereas mm-hmm. other places would have, like, no, we can't let them go out of frame, and because then people won't know what happens when they come back. And the reality is, no one cares what happens when they come back. They just want to follow this bird through the city. You know, I watched it with my little brother. My brother's 22, and, like, he was totally kid, like 12, immediately once that sequence started. It was just really mm-hmm. thrilling to go through. And I don't know anyone else could have shot that in a way that, like, when James Cameron shoots it, you have a little bit of momentum, and you are like, yeah, shoot those guns. But here it's sort of a sense of adventure, which is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, the time that we got the first sense, or, like, at least I got the first sense of what we were in for, in terms of sort of, Here's Steven Spielberg, who no longer has to worry about the restraints of a physical camera. Like, he can do anything he wants with this camera and move it in any direction. Is the scene where Tintin was in the street trying to avoid being hit by the cars.
Yeah.
And the camera is just, like, 360, like just whirling around him. And all these different angles are coming up as, you know, this story is going on. It was like, I actually got this feeling, and, like, the person I was watching the movie with, like, actually exclaimed, he's like, whoa, just from the exaggerated movement. It was like that camera never stopped moving. Sure. Like, it was always in motion, you know? So it's like, this is what happens when the reins come off Mr. Spielberg.
Well, yeah, it's funny because I just started counting the chases at the beginning. The first chase is the cat. In the room, and once that happened, I was like, "This is going to be a chase movie." So I started counting, and it just chase after chase after chase after chase.
Uh-huh. Well, I was curious. I know that we also just saw Puss in Boots not too long ago, and how would you compare Puss's kind of perspective? Remember when Puss was up he was up on the rooftops, and he kind of did one of those, like, come down the line kind of thing, and he jumped up and down, and he was going up and over things. How would you compare that to what we saw in 10-10? Similar or better or worse?
Well, I think it's similar, but it's similar, but it seemed like with 10-10, it felt way more choreographed as far as all the action that was going on around. Like, when you had a scene like that in Puss in Boots, it seemed very much focused on Puss, and you were just sort of focused all your attention on him. But, like, when you know, either the cat scene or the chase through the city in Baghdad and that whole action sequence, like Carlos said, there's this sense of all this stuff going on at the same time, you know, because all these things going on, all these other characters involved. So to me, it sort of felt, and it's sort of a cliche, but it felt more epic almost, as far as the shots, just the way that he moved the camera around, and again chose to focus on what he did as he was going around. But I never felt like I was missing out on anything. It all felt rather natural.
There's nothing I've ever seen this year like when the bicycle, the motorbike brakes and he gets on the clothesline. That I've never I've never seen as good of a shot digitally as that sequence. Like that 5-10 seconds where he's on the line, that is just fantastic. That's what you kind of wish people did when they have all encumbered by stuff. That's the kind of stuff you want them to do.
Right. I did have, though, there were parts of it, and I don't know if I can cite any real specific examples, a lot of it involving maybe Snowy. I mean, the dog is adorable. You know, made me want to go run out and get a fox terrier. But there were certain elements of the story that, like, I felt like there was times when they were going for, like, hyper-realism in terms of the way people moved and the way things were set. And then the story would sort of do this little jog into something sort of comical or something I would expect from a different sort of story. Like the sequence with the plane.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was obviously very sort of exaggerated, sort of Saturday morning cartoonish to me, you know,
like there were these... when the Rottweiler suddenly became a little bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. But there were little pieces of that. And I think that was the only thing that it kept kind of jogging me in and out of the story. I it kind of gone along with, like, there were parts of it where I felt were very Indiana Jones, which is sort of, you know, very hyper action oriented, but ultimately sort of realistic to totally unrealistic things that couldn't possibly happen. And this kept just jumping in and out of that. And it was sort of jarring to me sometimes.
I think I call it the airbender problem.
There you go.
It's the issue when you're going from slapstick comedy to fart jokes to epic magic Karate Kid to slapstick joke to the cabbages. You're like flying through all these shifts.
And I was also really, really surprised by the amount of violence. And I guess they said that he was trying to stay true to the source material. Because there's a lot of gun violence in this. And knowing how he sort of had sort of knee-jerk reactions to guns and taking guns and stuff out of his own movies, I was rather surprised of the amount of stuff that was in this one. And it really didn't hit me until afterwards while I was sitting in a bar, which is kind of funny. of just the amount of alcohol use that is in this movie for being sort of like a children's movie.
You also have to realize, at least along the gunplay line, no one ever hits anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for the FBI agent, he got hit. But
yeah, he got hit a couple times.
Yeah,
no blood.
Yeah, but the amount of alcohol in this movie is sort of staggering. There's a lot of drinking.
Oh, Haddock was a drunk. I mean, that's
he wasn't a drunk. He was drunk drinking for he was drinking like 300 proof stuff. I mean, they made it comical about it. Like, he drank so much that his breath was acted as fuel for the plane.
Right. So I guess the movie's catching a little flack for that alcohol.
The medicinal alcohol stuff.
Yeah.
But that's again staying true to the source material.
And the time period.
Right. Exactly.
My weird bit about that kind of thing, my brother noticed it. He was like, this kid keeps getting hit on the head a lot. So like, there was like a bit of like, it became a running gag about how often he got hit on the head with something.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, overall, I mean, I enjoyed it. Like, one of the people I saw, and like, I know you guys like said you weren't too affected by the Uncanny Valley thing. One of the people that I saw it with was totally, totally taken out of the movie because of it.
Oh, really?
Just completely not. I mean, he was just like, yeah, I just couldn't. He's like, anytime that the captain was on the screen, I just couldn't watch it. Like, it would made him uncomfortable to watch.
Wow. It's a fascinating issue.
Well, it is, and that's part of the thing, is that it's a very sort of irrational thing. It's not something you really control. You either feel uncomfortable by it or you don't, and it's hard to nail down. Now, I did think of you, Jeff, when I was watching this.
How so?
Were you freaking out during the trying to get the keys scene?
Oh, no.
I figured you'd be freaking out.
Probably because I, you know, watched the trailer so many times that I was like, you know, but I wasn't like freaking out like I had to cover my eyes or anything. But I think part of that was because I'd seen the trailer, which basically showed that entire scene. Okay. So I knew what was going to happen. He was going to go after the sandwich. He was going to get the sandwich. There was going to be a bunch of tumbling. And in the end, they would have the keys. Mm-hmm. And
talk about cartoonish. If you want to talk about cartoonish, that's a great sequence where the guys are falling on him and they're not waking up.
Yeah. Just ragdolling everywhere. Yeah.
But they're apparently used to that from being on the sea all the time. Mm-hmm. They would constantly fall out of bed and pile on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, that sounds like a bad porno. In any case, moving on to what we've learned from The Adventures of Tintin. The Secret of the Unicorn, which is really kind of the... Anyways. American Eagles...
It's a unicorn!
American Eagles, all hair, oil, and no socks. The aggressive ones always seem to be the first to roll over on their backs. Well, meaning the dogs. Police work is not all glamour and gunfights. And there are worse things than sobering up. And realist is just another word for failure. That is what we've learned.
That's a good one.
Adventures of Tintin. I really like this film. Something about the motion capture made things seem a little weird, but it still ended up being fantastic. Reminds me of Adventures movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark. By the way, it's Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's not Indiana Jones and the Raiders, not Lost Ark. It's just Raiders of the Lost Ark. Get over it. Yes. Anyways.
I thought it was a fun film. It dipped and weaved in and out of the uncanny valley for me, but it wasn't a deal breaker. It was way more violent than I expected it to be. So be aware of it. You know, there's some issues there before taking your kids. I'd recommend people go see it. 3D was done well. I did see it in 3D, but I didn't feel it was necessary for viewing.
What was the movie rated? Can you remember?
I honestly don't even pay attention to what
I don't rated. Either generally, but I'll just say I didn't hate it. I actually thought it looked better than other films, specifically the most recent Indiana Jones and actually the Pirates movies. I actually thought it felt a lot smoother than some of the Pirates movies did. I think they actually should have done young Indiana Jones like this. But I don't particularly feel it was a kid's movie, perhaps more PG-13 on that side, especially with all the violence, swords, mm-hmm. etc.
The movie was rated PG, in case you were wondering. It clearly was the best directed and shot of the CG animated films that have been coming out in the last days. It really shows that Spielberg had a really strong idea about what it is he wanted all the sequences to look like and how they wanted to move together, and that was pretty cool. It was surprisingly drunken and violent and had all these sort of in jokes, I guess, like that I enjoyed, but I can imagine a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old kind of being confused by that. And there are some sequences of it that I feel very strongly about and no real sequences that bored me.
Mm-hmm. And that is The Adventures of Tintin. Moving on into the future.
Hi. Welcome to the future.
And I'm telling you, it's great here.
Yes, yes, I know we've done this before in the past, but we're going to do it again because there's a new trailer. In fact, it's an actual trailer. It's The Dark Knight Rises, directed by Christopher Nolan, starring Christian Bale, Tom Hardy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Gary Oldman, Anne Hathaway, Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, Marion Cotillard. Star-studded cast.
Yep.
So 8 years after the events of The Dark Knight, the terrorist leader Bane arrives in Gotham City, pushing it and its police forces to the limit, forcing its former hero Batman to resurface after taking the fall for Harvey Dent's crimes. So, Batman Rises.
First thing I want to say is, I'm assuming, Carlos, you saw Mission Impossible 4 mm-hmm. already. Did you see it in IMAX?
Well, no, but I eventually found it online, like all good geeks.
Okay, so you did see the little sneak peek.
Look for that.
Okay.
I haven't seen it yet, but I did find it online. But I haven't seen
okay.
it.
I will say, I mean, I've seen this trailer. I've seen it a bunch of times. I've slow-mo'd through the trailer. That being said, watching the trailer and then seeing the I think it's the first 7 minutes of it. Is that what they show?
That's what they're saying.
Seeing the first 7 minutes of the film is making me want to go see this movie. Not that I wouldn't go see it anyway, but between the two, if I had to pick between what's making me want to go see this movie, it's definitely that sneak peek over this trailer. The trailer's cool. I like some of the things that the trailer shows. But the sneak peek thing is, and it's really one of the driving forces for making me go see Mission Impossible. I want to go see
One, I don't know exactly what we expect this trailer to do. So it's sometimes hard to say, especially for a movie that there aren't that many people who are still on the fence about whether or not they're going to see The Dark Knight Rises. Mm-hmm. But the first one, I don't know how the 8 minutes fits into the rest of the movie. Some people talk that it's a prologue. Some people talk that it's the actual first 8 minutes of the movie. Some people talk that it's just a separate thing that kind of introduces you to Bane. It's unclear exactly how it fits to the rest of the movie, so I didn't know how to judge it. But I did use it to say, okay, if this is the scale that we're working on, like the things that happen in that 8 minutes are pretty intense.
Yes.
And I've never seen have happen before on film before.
Yes.
That's a lot of scores. And so I'm like, if this is the scale we're working on, then I'm curious about what kind of things we're going to see in The Dark Knight Rises. And considering all the leaks and there's like people following the production and writing down what they see, we have a fairly good idea of what kind of pieces are in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's just another piece of information to throw into that fire of speculation about what's going on. The trailer, though, I think does a better job than the 8 minutes does, because the trailer gives you some sense of, what this story is going to be about and how it connects to the other movies, and, of course, has the moment of wonderful theater where, you don't know what's going on, and then suddenly the runner is running back and the ground is falling around him. I've seen this trailer 5 times in a movie theater, and every time the audience just gasps when that happens. Even people who've seen it before, it's an amazing moment, and I can't wait for that moment in the movie just to see how that buildup happens.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton that goes on in the trailer. This is what I would say. This franchise, like we said, it's the trailer is more of, or is less of a here's what we're going to show you to get you to come see this movie. Because all the people that are going to come see it are going to come see it regardless. I think they could have just not released anything but that teaser trailer. And the same amount of people are going to come see it.
That teaser trailer was awesome, though.
this when you get to a franchise like this, the trailers, when they come out, they're more of like, this is an event. We're going to allow you to see what we've been working on, since we last left you with the previous movie. Here's where we're going, and here's the little snippets. And that's exactly the reason why people like me, download it and watch it in slow motion, because we're trying to take in as much as we possibly can of this little glimpse we get of a trailer of the things in there. So you could sort of take it all in and sort of see what lies in store for us. And I will agree, yes, the trailer does a good job of sort of conveying the story and what we are going to see, but it was the sheer amazement of the things that they did in that sneak preview that made me want to go see. I was like, I want to know how they shot that. Like, how much of that is real and how much of it is CG? Because like you said, there's things that they did in that I've never seen before. And I was like, holy crap. How do they do that?
We should speak more specifically. The splitting of a plane, of an actual big plane, in half.
Yes.
And
while it's in flight. I've never seen before.
While it's in flight, and ripping the wings off, and then splitting in half, and so that all is left is him hugging the guy, and it's very impressive.
Yes. If you
the trailer, since none of us have seen the other, not all of us have seen the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think there's HD version of those 8 minutes out there now.
So what do you guys think of the trailer?
Oh, I like the trailer. I thought the trailer was great. I'm just saying that it's not, if I have to weigh the two, it's not what's pulling me in to see the movie. I mean, obviously, sure. I don't think if I didn't see either one of these, it would still I'd still go see the movie. But that the sneak peek is for me is what's making me go, oh my god, I want to go see what the hell they have in store for us here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, you guys probably know. I guess I could look it up online. What role is Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing in the film?
He's playing some guy.
Some guy. He's not playing like
Scarecrow.
Okay, we don't know yet.
No, it's a. No, he's got the John Blake.
Yeah, so we don't really know.
Hard-nosed young Gotham beat cop who is secretly Seymour. Who is secretly helping Batman to bring down the supervillain known as Bane.
Well, John Blake isn't a person in the Batman universe. So I guess they created him for that movie.
Well, this story is not in the Batman universe. I mean, the Nolanverse is something completely outside of anything from we previously had. And from what it sounds like here is almost as if it's like Gordon passes the torch onto John Blake.
Okay.
So, or at least just from the description, that's what it seems like. It's like Gordon's retiring. I mean, like in the trailer, he said he's an old war hero, and he's passing it on to somebody who's there, who's willing to work with Batman, and helping to bring down Bane in this case.
Well, I'm looking at some message boards here while you guys are talking, and there's speculation on his character all over the place. As far as some people say that he's going to end up being Nightwing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Some people say that he's going to end up being the one that takes over for Batman when Bane gets finished with him.
They're going to make him the Azrael character?
No, because from what I've read, this is not the first time that Batman has interacted with Bane. So this isn't the Nightfall storyline. This is like after the Nightfall storyline. Like, remember, this is 8 years. A lot happens in the 8 years between this one and that one. So there's some speculation that this isn't the breaking of the bat and then moving on. This is them getting together with some history.
Mm.
But again, well, it's all speculation.
None and you would think in that 8 years, Bruce would have run into Dick Grayson, eventually Jason Todd. And
no, that's not going to happen. But that's not going to happen because of...
it's the Nolanverse.
Well, no, it's Christian Bale. Christian Bale won't allow that to happen because that means he'd have to share the spotlight with somebody.
Well, and also this is going to be the last Nolanverse movie,
and it's also
Christian Bale
stated,
will no longer be Batman after this movie. So,
well, Christian Bale stated he would not play Batman if Robin appeared anywhere in the trilogy, and Christopher Nolan agreed to include Robin, agreed not to include Robin, as it would undermine the dark tone of the series.
Yeah, well, yeah, so this is a completely different universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you include Nightwing, though, it doesn't quite have to be that way, but that's technicalities.
Well, but in order for Nightwing to come about, you have to have a Robin because it's Dick Grayson, and I'm sorry.
Well, no, if you skip 8 years, you can do a lot of things.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I think that's a Christian Bale issue.
I guess my question to everybody is then, is there anything from this trailer you were expecting to see that you didn't?
Expecting to
actually
see Catwoman.
Being huge.
Wait, so you guys are both talking at the same time. Somebody, Steven, you go.
I wanted to see what Catwoman looks like.
Okay.
I will say that. I was figuring we might get a glimpse of Catwoman.
Like in costume?
Yeah.
Because we saw Selina Kyle, yes, we know. But we didn't actually see her all Catwoman up. Also, Bane was too small.
Well, you can't have Bane look like what he actually looks like. I mean, that's like having the blob, like having the blob in the X-Men series. Like, unless he's going to be entirely CGI, it's just not going to work out that he's going to be.
What about Bane from Batman and Robin? Sure, they made him dumb and stuff, but still, the look of Bane from Batman and Robin looked really good.
Yeah, I think once they made a decision that he was going to be Batman's equal in multiple ways, they went away from the luchador thing.
Right.
And some people are obviously going to miss that a lot.
I think, hey, Tom looks fine to me.
You always think Tom looks fine.
And Tom looks fine to me. It's fine.
Yeah, I he doesn't seem as warrior Tom-ish.
Yeah, I think he actually looks bigger.
But I mean, I don't think, but I don't think Tom Hardy looks as buff as he did when in Warrior.
Or as buff as he does in that Spy versus Spy trailer.
Yeah, that's true. He was all over that. I think I saw him in like two different trailers plus something else while I was at the theater. I'm like, holy crap, he is just all over the place.
He is blowing up.
Yeah. But I don't know. I guess I saw everything that I was expecting to see. I wasn't really disappointed by, you know, I was amazed by how little of actual Batman we saw in the trailer.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. That was about my only thing. I was like, wow, it's a Batman trailer and there's like really no Batman in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, there's probably one more trailer remaining before we can count it down.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. You know, and I'm still a little, you know, I'm still a little butthurt that they moved most of the principal photography out of Chicago into Pittsburgh, but that's just me.
Did you say butthurt?
Uh-huh.
Never heard that phrase before. It must be a Chicago thing.
No. It's a nerd thing.
Okay. Interesting.
Nope.
So, yeah, what are we thinking?
I think it's nice to see more in this trailer. However, it's suddenly not as excited as it before. It's still one of the top movies on my list to see, but something about the trailer didn't increase my excitement. So I'm not any more excited. I'm actually probably more towards meh now.
I think it's just overwhelmed. You know, it's just so many games, so many movies looking up to.
Right. I was more excited by the sneak preview as far as what's drawing me in than the trailer. I'm excited to see it, but it's not. I don't think I'm excited to see it because of the trailer. I'm gonna go see this movie regardless. They could have not shown me anything, and I'll go see it. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. I'm gonna go see this movie regardless.
Yeah, it's like Avengers. We're gonna see Avengers no matter what happens.
True.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was the best Nolanverse trailer to date, in my opinion. As not a purist of Batman and all that kind of stuff. Now, that's the one thing I need to throw out here. I'm not as geeked out about you as the rest of you are.
Mm-hmm.
But I find this trailer to be the best one that I've liked the most. And I finally it's one that excited me. Okay, maybe it's Tom Hardy, but it will get me to the theater.
Right. So. Okay.
Carlos?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you needed a recap. But yeah, I mean, I think we've been thinking about this movie for at least a year now. You know, every bit of it is leaked out through the various blogs, various news sites. Everything is sort of hyper-analyzed. So I don't know how much enjoyment I can get out of, how much extra anticipation I have left in me, you know? I'm already on the verge of exploding. I don't know how much more we got to go. But I will say that when I watched the 8 minutes, I was very impressed with the scale of it, and that made me interested to see what we were doing. And then when I watched the trailer, I was like, okay, whatever, whatever. And then it says, you know, like you look up at the skyline that's cut out to have the Batman signal, and then there's that two-chord finishing sort of thing, and I saw it in one of the big theaters with this huge sound system, and the whole room shook. I was a sense of, like, this is why we look forward to it every year. Whenever there's a next big movie, it's the sense of event, and an event, it's an event. Storylines, I'm very glad on a nerd level that there's this interesting character arc between the three movies. I appreciate that it's really thought out. And so it's a wonderful set of movies. But beyond that, it's a movie that every time we get any little piece of information about it, we are jacked up a little bit more. But I think I've reached my limit now. I don't want to hear anything about Batman now until, like, March. And then I will start being excited again.
So you can build up for July.
Yeah.
All right.
Next summer is going to be just, I don't know if I'm going to make it alive through all the movies that I have to see next summer.
Hey, we have to see 52 a year, so. In any case, that's it. That's it for this reel of COL Movies. Next week, our coming attractions will be Casablanca, Warhorse.
Say it correctly. Warhorse. Every time I watch the damn trailer, it's my horse. No, it's the horse. No, it's... I'm like, oh, Lord, how am I going to make it through this movie?
Warhorse. And in the future, we're going to be taking a look at Prometheus. There's plenty of ways to contact us. Let us know what you think about each and every one of these movies. We really like to hear from you. You can do that by going to our website, colmovies.com. Leave a comment on our blog. Also, you can email us at colmovies@gmail.com. Leave us a voicemail. Give us a call at 361-265-8255. That's 361-COL-TALK. Also, follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/COLmovies, which is essentially pulling everything from Facebook at facebook.com/COLmovies. Please pop onto iTunes. Leave us a review, preferably 5 stars. Please, thank you. And with that, any final thoughts?
I hope everybody had a great holiday and has a wonderful and safe new year.
Yep. Looking forward to the 2012 movies.
Yeah.
Ditto.
That's it for this year. So we will see you all next year. It looks like we got a bunch of things that we're going to be looking at here. Casablanca, as we said, next week, we're going to be taking a look at Red State. That's going to be a good big one. I'm going to be recapping Ghost Rider. It's going to be fun. Clash of the Titans, because of the new Wrath of the Titans coming up. Out some other classics, funnies, musicals, I think. No, that's not a musical. Never mind. I'll throw one in there somewhere, but probably not until later in the year. So we have about 5 more months before another anniversary.
No, crazy.
Oh, I think we're seeing Death Becomes Her for our anniversary, so that will be fun. So for me, for Fuzz, for Steven, and for Carlos, take care, everyone.
Hasta la vista, baby.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
That'll do, too.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.
He's looking at you, kid.
End of line.
Warhorse. Oh, Lord.
I'm going to have to keep that on the end.
Warhorse.
Warhorse.
I feel like Adele is going to say it. Warhorse. They're rolling in the deep.